Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
So I'm James Mitchell from Orchid Studio. I'm the founder and director.
And I'm Carolina Larrazabal, design director of Orchid Studio.
This week's programme was recorded in Nairobi as part of a series of episodes we're bringing you from East Africa to explore identity and architecture. Identity is the theme of this year's London Festival of Architecture.
We're perhaps known in many regards as being a design or an architecture firm, but we're actually registered here as a main contractor. So we provide a full end-to-end design and construction service. Everything that we design, we build, and everything we build, we design. You know, often people underestimate or perhaps don't acknowledge the full diversity, you know, across not even the whole continent, but just Kenya. I mean, from the dry, arid north to the tropical west to the hot, humid coast, I mean, it's vastly different. Even a couple of hours drive out of Nairobi and you're in a very different landscape.
On the programme this week, we speak to James Mitchell and Carolina Larrazabal from Orchid Studio in Nairobi. Orchid Studio was founded in 2008 by James Mitchell and Julissa Kalenge in Cardiff, where the pair studied. Their aim was to establish a practice interested in providing architectural services to a wider section of society. Much of their early work was conducted during holidays and time away from study and teaching, where James taught at the McIntosh School of Architecture. The practice made the decision to relocate the practice from Glasgow to Nairobi in 2016. We joined James and Carolina on the terrace of their studio in Nairobi earlier on this year, where I started by asking about their move to Nairobi.
And first came over here about 10 years ago. I studied architecture in Cardiff at the Welsh School of Architecture, and I met a Ugandan girl who had been born and brought up here in Nairobi. That introduced us to Kenya, and we've sort of been back and forth ever since.
So standard BA in architecture, what was the kind of drive to become an architect? What led you to study architecture?
Well, particularly this type of work, the starting of Orchid Studio was a reaction to the way that we perceived the perception when we studied. So first year of architecture, really loved it, but found that everything was for high value public clients or wealthy clients. And we were really interested in why architecture services were not more widely available. And that's really driven at least the early years of Orchid Studio and the work we've done since.
But before going on to university, what was the kind of, I'm always interested in what drives people to become, study architecture, to go on to be an architect, what was the kind of?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of I think growing up, most of the time I wanted to design cars. I had a real interest in, I was very creative, but I always knew I wanted to do something with my hands where I was actually constructing something. And so architecture just seemed to fit, really, that balance between creativity and being able to make things. Although that's in many ways not that accurate these days, and maybe part of what we've gone on to do since is a reaction to that as well.
Yeah, okay. And you studied architecture, Carolina?
I studied architecture in Spain, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what, again, were you, the kind of drive to be an architect, often people are led in, I guess, by parents being architects or people
yeah,
by...
nothing like that, really. No, my family's an architect. No. I just, I guess it's the typical combination of I like the arts, but I also like the kind of scientific stuff, physics and all this sort of thing. And I just saw in architecture that it did a little bit of everything, a bit of culture, history, a little bit of art, but also, some functionality added to it. And I just went for it. Yeah.
So then after, James, after architecture school, so did you BA in Cardiff,
Cardiff and Masters.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then went into practice after then, or immediately, what was the kind of transition into?
So I set up Orca Studio actually when I was 19, out of my first year. And we started constructing buildings at that time.
Right.
Something of a naive venture, fueled with the enthusiasm of and confidence of youth.
Yeah. No one would ever start anything otherwise.
Yeah,
I think,
the best things I'm told are start that way. No plans at all. So I did, for many years it evolved as this thing that we would do during our summers or time that we had away from studies. I practiced a bit. I worked for Shigeruban in Tokyo, working on the Haiti earthquake appeal at that time, 2010. And then after I graduated, I did do a little bit of time in a couple of architecture studios in the UK. And I also lectured for 5 years at the McIntosh School of Architecture. But at that time, it was running modules in international development and architecture and that connection. Even at that stage, and this is sort of 6-7 years in from founding the organization, I hadn't found a clear path to make it sustainable. But now, through 3 years ago, we moved the practice to Nairobi, headquartered it here, closed down the office in Glasgow, and that's just made such a major impact. Being so proximate and close to the people we're trying to serve has changed the whole way we practice, but also our ability to do it in a self-sustaining way. Yeah.
So I've spoken to architects who've been educated in Kenya and some of the architecture schools here. Kind of interested then in your perceptions, having studied outside and moved into the country, of how architecture is perceived as a profession, or is how architects are. A number of people have said that architecture's been seen, one of the reasons they've gone into architecture was because it was seen almost like the law or almost like medicine as being one of the kind of top level professions. Mm. And is that maybe not quite always the case in the UK? Just interested in your perceptions of
Yeah, and we have done some work with the universities here as well. So we've been privileged to have the insight to how the profession is perceived at the sort of ground level. I think that there's a real challenge here. Architecture, as you point out, is seen as one of the sort of traditional formal professions, and to some extent that maybe aligns it a little more with engineering than it does with creativity. And also to some degree with humanity and with human-centered approaches. I've always felt that cities like Nairobi or even the wider country has a real crisis of identity when it comes to architecture. Yeah. In part, that's perhaps because there's not the depth of history in the urban fabric that's been iterative over generations.
Yeah.
We often, in our own practice, refer to the vernacular, the various tribal vernaculars here in Kenya and further in East Africa, buildings which are made from incredibly basic and primitive resources, but which fundamentally work for the climate and to some extent the culture. But the buildings that are built in the city now or even in rural areas that are modern, whether that's reliance on a tin roof sheet or steel and glass, often are imported ideas from Europe or the US, where there's a real culture and value in design and a celebration of design. And I think that's a real frustration, something that we're trying to make a huge impact on, not just through our own work, but by employing Kenyans, by engaging Kenyans in the work that we're doing, to understand that actually their climate here is entirely different to a Northern European climate or a Western climate.
Yeah.
And so therefore it's a different set of principles that need to guide that process.
I'm kind of interested then in how a number of people have spoken about the role that kind of social media and quite a tech savvy young population are looking for influences, whether it's on Dazeen or on Instagram. How relevant is that in terms of, the kind of influences you're trying to work with people to, reinterpret their own vernacular? How does that?
I think Kenya is a really, Nairobi in particular is an incredibly exciting city, and it's a city that where I find there's so much optimism, and that optimism is driven by particularly the younger generation here, both international people coming in, but in particular the young Kenyan socially minded entrepreneurs that are beginning to work here. The tech industry, as you refer to, is particularly exciting in that regard. There's a lot of stuff going on, making use of the actually far superior mobile technology infrastructure that exists here. But I'm seeing that start to come into architecture and design. But I think it's from my perspective, it's really early days. I think that value, that innovation, particularly innovating with local resources rather than innovating by copying what might be innovative elsewhere, I think still needs to develop. And there's, for the size of city and the population here, there's a surprising lack of opportunities for people to engage in that, and practices actually leading the way, which is something that I hope will change in the near future.
So maybe then, just, I know we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but you met before you both moved to Kenya? Did you move here separately? Did you know each other before?
I started at Orchid Studio just as we were making the move to Kenya.
Okay.
Basically, a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So, yeah, but we knew each other there.
Okay. How did you meet then?
I applied.
Okay, you applied.
And they got
okay.
me. Yeah.
So tell me about the kind of the size of the practice now, and what you kind of, the bit about the story about the practice kind of founding and deciding to up sticks and move.
So I think it's maybe worth talking about the context when we started. In 2007-2008, architecture, human-centered architecture, was not really a thing, or at least it wasn't really a thing that people were commonly talking about and that you would see in the media. There were organizations at that time like Architecture for Humanity, which has since collapsed, and perhaps Architecture Sans Frontières, but not a lot of others. And so at the time, we didn't really know any other model than traditional charity. Yeah. And we started our projects by raising funds back in the UK or Europe and coming over here, donating our skills and our time and paying for the materials and the labor to get buildings for communities or organizations where there was a clear need. And we worked in about 8 or 9 different countries across Africa, South America, and Southeast Asia during the sort of 6-7 years after that. And we found that although on the whole the experience was good, the impact was meaningful, but quite often these buildings that we were donating were becoming more of a burden to that community or were being undervalued in ways that we had never quite imagined. And with that, and over the period that we were delivering those projects, there was a real surge in wider development thinking that charity simply doesn't work, and that social enterprise, or in other words, facilitating others to build their own livelihoods through real access to markets and to the economy, was a far more lasting approach. And so we started to question, well, how do we do that as architects? And again, there were very little alternatives to look at. There were, even today, there's still practices in the UK or elsewhere that will do a couple of projects in East Africa or whatever on the side. And in many ways, that actually detracts from the industry here. It gives a lot of practices here or takes away the opportunity to work on a lot of these projects. And so we really felt that with this, we got to a point, a bit of a crossroads, where we felt we don't actually want to be donating our time, not because the causes are not perfectly meaningful or not because we shouldn't be helping other people, but simply because by respecting our time and the value of that, and by generating an actual enterprise or social enterprise here, we were not only enabling ourselves to have more impact, but we were enabling others to be a part of that. And so we've grown, we're now a team of just under 20 people. But what's particularly different about the way that our practice has evolved is we're perhaps known in many regards as being a design or an architecture firm, but we're actually registered here as a main contractor. So we provide a full end-to-end design and construction service. Everything that we design, we build, and everything we build, we design. And we find that that's a far more exciting way to be in control of that process, that creative process, to ensure that not only the architectural material ambitions are delivered, but also that the community is brought in. So we train women in construction through all of our projects. We maintain 50% women across all of our workforces, and our buildings are built by the community rather than by a professional, highly skilled team. And so that brings with it certain challenges, but also a far greater social depth that you wouldn't get elsewhere.
I mean, that really, that kind of idea about building yourself is, I guess, at kind of odds to the trend of Chinese construction, particularly now, and kind of Chinese investment and contractors, and the bigger firms talking about working with Chinese contractors because they offer such good kind of value as they see it. But it's interesting, that desire to be part of the building process yourself as a...
But I think it answers a major issue here. I mean, Chinese contractors and Chinese investment is obviously doing a lot for the country at that major infrastructural scale. We're not building massive roads and huge other public infrastructure. And so what's below that?
Yeah.
And there are local contractors here, and there are good local contractors here. But generally speaking, the quality of construction is incredibly poor.
Yeah.
There was a survey done 2 years ago, 2016, after the rains that came, big monsoon period, May, June, that was done by the National Construction Authority, that found that 58% of Nairobi's buildings are unfit for habitation. And this was following the collapse of a 10-story building in an area of the city here. And that's a pretty major thing to happen. This is not poor quality infrastructure that we're used to seeing in the slums, Kibera or Kawangware. Mm. This was a major building that had gone through, in principle, the right processes. And that's quite simply down to poor quality design and cutting corners during construction. And I think it goes far, for us, it goes far beyond that. We talk a lot in design about how do we design for health. And not just in healthcare, but how do we design healthy buildings which can actually improve the quality of life here? So many buildings go up here without any hint to daylight, ventilation strategy, thermal comfort, and actually just being a space that you want to spend your time in. You know, we're around this table, we're all into architecture, but buildings make you feel something, whether you're conscious of it or not. And I think this is a major, major public health and public sort of satisfaction and happiness issue, which is happening right in front of us that nobody's paying attention to. Buildings that are forcing people to live in places that are stressful, that are uncomfortable. The spaces between buildings are given very little thought. And I think that, I think this is a major problem that's derived not just from designers, but also from how we're approaching building at every level in this city, or in, or more widely in this part of the world.
I'm interested then whether there's a kind of, you're talking there about the city, and whether there's a kind of, talking about the spaces between the buildings and the kind of disconnect, really. Yeah, large parts of the city are accessible by car, I guess, and it's quite a kind of car-centric city. That's, I guess, at the other end of the scale of work that you're doing. But is there much kind of focus there in the profession in Kenya on master planning or on city layout, city design?
There is work going on to try and improve. Certainly traffic, I think, is a major issue here. Yeah. Any of you live here, it can be quite challenging at times to get anywhere in any reasonable space of time.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, there's not a cohesive city plan or vision for the city. Certain bottlenecks are often relieved and then create two or three other smaller bottlenecks around them. So our work perhaps doesn't work at that scale. I don't think, you know, we're not trying to tackle traffic issues, and that's not really part of our work. But we are working in a lot of informal areas. We have a large project at the moment in Kibera, which is building a much more formalized architecture in an incredibly informal area, an area where there's actually no official streets and no official property boundaries. And that then immediately presents the question, what impact is our building having on the future of that part of the city? when at some point that those infrastructures will be put in place. I think it's an ongoing challenge, but it's something that architects here, too often buildings here finish at the point where they hit the ground. And I think that there needs to be that wider consideration of the space.
And kind of, might be helpful for listeners then if you just say about the sort of projects, a few examples of the projects you've been working on, whether it's talked a bit about the kind of informal kind of housing and and slum areas. And I guess the perception might be that it's those sort of housing projects principally that you're doing, or is that a...
We do a remarkable range of projects. We generally focus more on who we work for than what we're building. So we like to work with organizations or individuals whose own social vision is in line or as strong as ours. And so we have built everything from healthcare centers, hospitals, clinics, to affordable housing, a lot of schools, and even right now we're doing some large waste processing facilities on the outskirts of Nairobi, which are large industrial facilities. So there's a real range there, but certainly land issues are a major problem here. There's a really, really amazing organization called Landesa, actually, who are doing a lot to try and secure land tenures for communities. We have had projects that have been stopped because there's been multiple claims to a piece of land or objections to a wider range of the community. So it's a major challenge here, and how that gets formalized and how that is done in a way that actually includes everybody, because private ownership here is the main form of land ownership, and so that then often means that the land prices here are very high. Development has to be very dense and urbane, and it's driven a lot by that economy rather than by necessarily the wider needs of the people.
Right. Okay. And then, interesting, I guess, kind of in housing is a big issue in the UK at the moment, and the kind of housing crisis. And I've obviously, on my short time here, only seen a kind of very brief overview of how Kenyans or Nairobians maybe live. What's the kind of typical kind of setup for housing for, I don't know, middle classes here? Is there a demand for apartments? Are there commonalities, I guess, between kind of, there's with land prices being a problem, there's housing prices going up, presumably similar kind of issues to around the world, I guess. So just kind of interesting, the kind of housing industry, I guess.
Nairobi's a rapidly growing city, right? It's an African boom city. There's huge numbers of people moving from rural to urban areas all the time. The coupling that with the land prices that I mentioned means that the vast majority of sort of inner city plots end up going 10 stories or more once they're developed. And so there's the format of living here, typically for the middle classes at least, is now apartments. There are larger, single house on nice rural, sort of semi-urban rural plots for wealthier strands of society. But I think where I'm seeing a lot of issues arise is around the lower income segment of the population. There's a lot of organizations trying to tackle low income housing or affordable housing, but affordable housing here, it means a very different thing. And so a lot of organizations will come in and they'll put stuff up that's maybe only, $50 a month to rent. But for a lot of people, $50 a month is not achievable for actually the larger part of the population. And so that bottom segment, many of whom are moving to the cities and are ending up in a lot of the informal slum areas, there's not really anything catering to that. And how you can do that in a way which is financially sustainable for both the landlord or the whoever's selling the properties to those who are actually going to occupy it is a challenge that I don't think anyone's really answered yet. Which is that then has that knock-on effect to wider issues of sanitation and public health. For a lot of Kenyans moving to a city like Nairobi, who have maybe been born and brought up outside of the city in a rural area, the idea of apartment living is quite alien. It's quite different. I mean, I can even say that myself. I grew up in a rural part of Scotland, and I'm still not quite used to the traffic noises at night. So it's a problem that a lot of us face. But a lot of people here in Kenya, their main industry, their main means of income is agriculture, or at least that's the skill set that they might have. And so quite often, typical Kenyan household in a rural area is a 50 by 100 plot or shamba, as it's known here, with a modest house built on it. And that land is used for either livestock or crops to at least sustain the family unit or more widely generate an income. And people don't necessarily move to the cities in search of quite that same lifestyle, but how somebody makes that transition from that sort of either pastoralist or agricultural lifestyle to a more urban lifestyle, particularly when the infrastructure is being built with a nod to Europe and to the US, very few people are actually thinking, well, how do we build up? How do we build with density in a way which actually reflects the lifestyles, even down to the way that people cook? Most people here will cook on a charcoal cook stove, yeah, rather than on a gas hob.
Yeah. And even want to do that in an apartment.
And of course people have to adapt, but there's actually, certain things that are better cooked on different methods. It's not that, for me, it's not that gas is the more developed or the better method of cooking. It's just different. And so how do we develop properties which are never going to replicate that rural environment, but which perhaps make or reflect or understand that culture in a different way? And I think that that's not happening, and that's creating strains in other areas that perhaps we're not measuring or not aware of, that do need to be thought of.
And that kind of, we touched on it a little bit earlier on, that kind of African Kenyan vernacular maybe, and how so much of the kind of original building stock here from pre-independence is kind of exported British buildings by British architects generally. Is that kind of reinterpretation of a Kenyan style? I mean, you say there's not actually a lot of built kind of, certainly in Nairobi, of history to fall back on, really. I mean, how do you kind of, that must come into your work. You must be thinking about the
architects are assessing that identity. Most of the Kenyan architects are going for glass buildings and things that are not from this culture. So how, we were talking before about vernacular architecture, but we're not literally gonna take the rural house and put it in the city. And there has to be some adaptation there. When we start designing, one of the things that we take into account a lot is how do we design for this climate, which is something that not many people are thinking about. They're just taking the innovative glass designs from elsewhere and just plotting it in here. So how do you design taking into account natural ventilation, natural light, all these sorts of things, and that. It creates a bit of a baseline, something to base ourselves upon, because otherwise it's kind of it's kind of hard to find that identity, and that then evolves from
there. But the identity of a building is defined by more than just its kind of climatic surroundings, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, but
you must be picking up influences from.
We definitely do, but as we said, we pick influences from vernacular architecture, but we translate them onto how would it be on this different setting? How do we adapt that? So it the influence comes from that, but is then adapted. So you're not literally going to see the typical Samburu house that you would see in the countryside. It's kind of.
But again, kind of some of the influences, the Kenyatta International Conference Center, and maybe they're slightly picking up or referencing kind of at least nominally kind of traditional designs there. But thinking about people's own background, certainly climatically, Spain, I guess, has more in common, in terms of kind of heat and light at least than the north of Scotland, maybe, or
maybe more than in the north of Scotland, a little bit more, but not that much. We still have quite a steep angle with the sun. And we still have, we do have some cold winters, not as cold as Scotland, but they are cold.
Okay.
So the method of the sign is totally different as well. It's not a literal translation at all.
No, I was just thinking about obviously people bring with them their own references and their own kind of upbringing as part of their work. I'm just interested in the kind of Spanish. You didn't study at Cardiff.
No, I studied in Pamplona in Spain. Okay. It's curious what you say because when I'm designing here, I tend to kind of go back to the Spanish, the courtyard systems that you can find in the south of Spain, or some materials like the clay tiles and how they use it to make even gutters, or how to use traditional materials in an innovative way. That Spain has taught me a lot in that, and I try to apply it into here. It's not it's not literally a point of influence I'm not trying to literally create Spanish buildings in here.
But there's interesting references and
So
you studied in Pamplona for what, undergraduate, and then
the system in Spain is a little bit different. It's just 6 years full stop, and you end up with a level equivalent to the master's in the UK. So I just studied the 6 years in there.
Okay. Yeah. And then moved to London, and then what was your trajectory into
I hopped on and off a little bit during my studies. I worked in South America, a little bit in Zurich with different practices, all kind of oriented to the human-centered design, and ended up in Orca Studio in Glasgow, I came at a moment where we were already starting to move from Glasgow to Nairobi, so I just arrived at the moment of implementing that and moving down here.
Okay. And we talked to a lot of architects who seem, I guess, whether it's what leads people into becoming architects, but architects as a profession seem very socially minded, I guess, whether it's just because they're thinking so much about how people live and how people work. There's often maybe more left wing in terms of kind of political outlook, or often, extrapolating extraordinarily. But there is a certain, amongst the architecture profession generally, certainly in the UK, kind of thought about progressive social issues. And you kind of see a lot of architects maybe, as you were saying earlier, getting roped into working on what you might otherwise call kind of houses for rich people. Do you think, how do people kind of, you've obviously found one way of making work out of, making a business, making a kind of livelihood out of that. It's quite an interesting route.
Yeah, I think there's been a boom over recent years, I think, of architects wanting to apply their specialisms, their experience to benefit a wider segment of society. And I think that's to some degree reflective of the wider sort of social, political, economic environment that we find ourselves in this decade and no doubt going forward. And I think even within the architecture profession, if you look at the last 30, 40, 50 years of architecture, really ever since the austerity of the 60s, architecture has been this more flamboyant, single practice name profession as the mainstream. And I think that perhaps this is people reacting to that in a way. A new generation, millennials or whatever you want to call it, perhaps even influenced by the wider spectrum of, quirky Silicon Valley startups and this sort of thing. And I think it's as much about wanting to help people and benefit society as it is, I think, as well about actually just wanting to practice in a very different way. The practice of architecture has become less creative. It's become more developer and design build led, and in many ways for good reasons. But I think that a lot of particularly younger architects entering the profession and perhaps feeling a little jaded about of maybe the offset between their expectations and the profession, which is in perhaps reflective of the gulf between the way we teach architecture and the way we practice architecture. But I also think that there's a, whatever the motivations, there's a desire there to think about the way in which we do this. Does it have to be like this? And can we deliver buildings in a different way that involves a different spectrum of people? And I think that's really exciting for the profession.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was talking to some of the other, perhaps more established, kind of older architects, I guess you might say, we've had on the podcast. You're talking about their early work with drawing boards and pens and, you know, thinking several times and then making a line on a page, and how the profession now, you know, so much done on computers and sat behind doing kind of automation and things. I'm always fascinated really for them that it's almost a kind of different profession, really, how it's changed kind of under their feet during a career, really. Yeah. And I think, you know, for you, maybe starting up a kind of going back to architecture's roots a little bit more on the kind of slightly pure, do you think of it as that, as a kind of purer form of architecture?
Yes, but without any sense that it's in any way higher than.
Yeah, there's no value judgment there. No.
Everything we're doing, I mean, a big, big shift in the way we practice, which is totally changes the opportunities that are in front of us, is the fact that we are constructing the buildings we're designing. And so the information that we provide, the process that we go for, doesn't rely on a network of half a dozen other consultants. We do everything in-house, so we're dealing directly with the client, but there's nobody else in that really involved beyond the client and the community involved in that process. And so we can design, we put things into computer as late a stage as possible. Mm. Everything's done, pen, models, paper, and increasingly full-scale mock-ups, and starting to use the sort of skilled labor workforces we have here and the women that we're training up to trial different ideas, to link that construction process back into the design process.
Yeah.
And the whole thing for me then becomes far more holistic in the way that we deliver a building. And we're even designing after we go to site. A lot of our buildings are not frozen at that stage.
Yeah. It's an evolution.
We know what it's going to look like. The overall design is done in the engineering, but the details, the colors that you pick, the final material choices, I think we're so much richer for being able to make that decision when you're stood in that building that's half up than just on paper or in your own head in the studio.
I was talking to Ken Shuttleworth, who was at Foster's before launching Make Architects in the UK, and he was, I think, one of his early projects at Foster's was the HSBC Bank, and he was talking about then working with kind of carbon copy paper and doing those sketches and signing them off actually on site, as they were there. I thought that's quite a nice loop back, really, into how very complicated buildings that they were designing were iterated, I guess, on site. That's a real... I just want to come on to the kind of identity of the practice, really, and we were talking before about practices often taking on the name of an architect, and you've obviously chosen not to do that. Where did the name come from?
Originally, it derives from Organization for Kids Studio, and it was a reflection of the work we were doing at the time. We were working mainly for primary schools and children's homes, work that always revolved around kids, basically. Now, perhaps our work has broadened. The meaning doesn't have quite the same weight for our work, but somehow the name has stuck.
Okay. And then interested in, you're talking about obviously the early influence in Uganda, but you're doing other work kind of internationally from Nairobi, and people talk often about London being a kind of global center for architecture and a lot of architects working overseas from London. Interested in the kind of international scope and how a lot of the other architects I've spoken to here have talked about working across East Africa and similarities, but how poorer some of the borders are, and the kind of East African identity being, I guess, at the moment segmented by countries, and kind of how that, your kind of take on that really would be interesting.
I'd definitely say the East African community is fairly strong. But there's such diversity here. I think there's, you know, often people underestimate or perhaps don't acknowledge the full diversity that is, you know, across not even the whole continent, but just Kenya. I mean, from the dry, arid north to the tropical west to the hot, humid coast. I mean, it's vastly different. Even a couple of hours drive out of Nairobi, and you're in a very different landscape. We've actually gone, I think, the opposite way to what might be considered traditional. We started off working totally internationally, three different continents, different countries, different parts of different countries all the time. And we made a conscious decision at the time that we moved here a few years ago that we were going to stop that, and we were going to really rein in our focus. So today we talk of really only working in Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia, which, don't get me wrong, is still a reasonable geography to work around. But even within that, we're trying to focus on specific communities and areas where we have built up knowledge, because that intense knowledge of the community, of the materials and the resources that are available, I think if we keep moving to different areas and constantly, we're never actually going to get very good at what we do. I think that being good at architecture or designing buildings that are actually have the maturity and the response to the culture and the function that they need to have requires you to become an expert. And there's architects that have committed their whole lives to that. A particular sort of go-to or favorite of ours is the Sri Lankan architect Jeffrey Bawa. And if you look at the geography of his work, it's just that island, and in many cases, actually just a particular part of that island. And you can see over the lifetime of his work how similar ideas, similar explorations that he's played with whether it be material or form or culture, have been consistent throughout his work. And I think that as a result, that's produced buildings that are really of a quality that right now we still look up to, and I'm sure many architects would. So I think there's a lot to be said actually for working just in your local area, as much as working internationally can be great as well.
Yeah. And then interested in your kind of experience as an immigrant, kind of coming into a country and fitting in and assimilating and picking up, you know, so much of London's architectural community is built on people coming into the country and the skills that they're bringing with them from elsewhere. How have you found the transition from Glasgow into Nairobi?
Well, gradual.
From Scotland, sorry, yeah. Where Glasgow came from. Yeah, well, from the Mac, I suppose. But yeah,
I mean, it's been gradual because I was coming here from such a young age and doing projects and spending little sort of. It's been a bit of a sort of trickle of time over a long extended period. But I found Kenya generally, and particularly Kenyans, to be incredibly welcoming and excited, I think, by the fact that there are practices like ours starting to show an interest here. Mm. But I think we also have a responsibility at the same time. I think we need to, and we do, employ our team's over 50% Kenyan. We are really interested in bringing in young, interesting architects and designers from the universities into our practice, because tomorrow's practice, when once we're not here or as this sector grows here, can't just be people from Scotland and Spain. It has to be a very much a locally driven thing. But I think Nairobi has that in the same way as London. It's multicultural. It's that is its personality. And, you know, the city is a much younger concept here. And so everybody's trying to, you know, work out how does this thing work? How does this country work? How does this culture of the city work? And how does Kenya develop? Because Kenya won't and should not develop in the same way that the European countries have or other areas of the world. And it's got to find its own way and its own feet. And I think there's such optimism here at the moment because I really do believe it's doing that.
Yeah.
But it's a process and it's going to take time. And I think that other people coming in and pitching their ideas will only strengthen that.
Yeah. That's really interesting, that kind of Kenyan idea of multiculturalism that a lot of talk in the UK about immigration and about as if it's a kind of solely a UK thing, but obviously the kind of Indian influence and the British influence and then kind of other waves of immigration into Kenya is, you know, makes it more maybe, you know, multicultural and than.
And bear in mind that the even the concept of being Kenyan is actually quite new to a lot of Kenyans.
Yeah.
I think it's something that's much more cohesive with the kind of current younger generation.
Yeah.
But that in itself is, you know, the diversity across the country is so huge that I think others coming in, as long as their approach and the way in which people coming in work is inclusive and is involves that wider spectrum, I think it only enhances the culture here.
And then I guess starting just to kind of think about rounding up, I was sort of interested in awards really and kind of rewarding the profession. You know, a large part of the kind of architectural community, you might say, in the UK is focused around recognition of peer recognition and recognition of others' work through whether it's the Stirling Prize or whether it's kind of any other awards. You've obviously had recognition in terms of up-and-coming architects through the Architecture Foundation and various kind of other places, but presumably that's fairly new in terms of award-winning or recognizing and awarding architecture and architects in Kenya. Is there much of a tradition of recognition here?
The local Architects Registration Board does a sort of an annual awards, but it's, you know, it's a local thing. It's not. Yeah. And I think that touches on an interesting point, and that's that right now in Kenya, there's not a lot of architects that are winning recognition beyond the boundaries of Kenya, either for work outside of Kenya or inside. And a lot of those that are reaping any kind of recognition in East Africa are often practices that don't even have an office here. And I think that that's, to some extent, I think that's a problem. As much as it can be celebrated as well, and some of the buildings that they're putting up are fantastic, I think that is a problem. And I think that that's something that, initiatives like Nairobi Design Week and other sort of festivals and celebrations of design generally is so important here, because there's actually not a lot of opportunity, like I said, I think at the beginning, to... for designers to connect and for people to look at and celebrate that work. But I think that's also perpetuated by the media outside of this continent. Yeah. I think that there's still this idea that, shall we call it human-centered or humanitarian or whatever sort of tag you want to put on the work that we do or others here do, it's almost seen as a separate thing.
Yeah.
You know, there has to be a special edition for a journal to publish it or whatever. But actually, and we've actually invited journalists and the media to come and visit some of our buildings.
Yeah.
We're still waiting. I think
an open invitation.
Yeah,
to
that's
people
an
listening.
Open invitation because I think it's vital. If you're going to critique and celebrate this work, you need to experience it.
Yeah.
And quite often, I think stuff gets very easily celebrated because of the sort of do-gooder hype that can surround these projects. Yeah. And I'm not saying that it's in any way false or not deserved, but we need to critique the work that's happening here on the same level as we would in Europe. And I think that that's something that one of the things that concerns me as the director of a practice here is we can, to be really blunt, we can kind of get away with anything here.
Yeah.
There's nobody critiquing our work, whether that's peers, whether that's the media, whether it's some other institution.
To drive up standards.
And we crave that. We want that. We want the opportunities to see other practices come in and really thrive here, because it will push us to be better and be more, and work harder and set the pace.
So that's a great point to end. Maybe the open... open call. How can people find out more about the practice and more about your work, more about your projects?
Our website, orcastudio.org, and we do publish a fair number of videos on Vimeo and Facebook.
Okay.
So look us up, follow us,
and
come join us if you're in this part of the world.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week were James Mitchell and Carolina Larastabau from Orchid Studio in Nairobi. You can find out more about James and Carolina and Orchid Studio at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed this week's programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. Music for this week's episode was from Peter Lagono and Raw Music International, available via the Free Music Archive and released under a Creative Commons license. You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. In Nairobi, I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.